Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Compassionate Communication 2, Emotional Agility by Lama Adam Berner. This talk will explore a middle way approach for our emotions. Rather than acting upon or suppressing our feelings, we can listen to what they are telling us and learn to surf the waves of emotional energy. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So I read this book a while ago called Say What You Mean by Oren J. Sofer for no particular reason other than it was about nonviolent communication, and I had an interest in that. I also like the idea that the author has a background in mindfulness, he has a background in training for nonviolent communication, and he has a background in somatics. And I thought that was a neat convergence, and turns out he also was a Buddhist monastic for a while. And I think I said this last time, but I love the fact that this book, I don't think he uses Buddhist language more than like three or four times in the whole book, but it's clearly derived from the teachings, you know, or at least accords with the teachings of the Buddha. So I hope to highlight some of that today. And I'll also state right at the top that there is to be a Sangha book club about this book coming up. And I think that's particularly awesome because we can kind of work on this on our own, but it's like any dharma. Like if we're doing it with other people who have similar ideas and are working with similar techniques and trying to remember similar stuff, it's going to work out a little better. We're going to reinforce each other. So I hope as many people as possible join in on that book study. It's going to be a conversational kind of thing. It's not like a teaching, like we're going to actually be doing applied exercises and things like that, from what I understand. It starts, the first one is Sunday, April 23rd, from 7 to 8. And there'll also be some involvement with a speaker, I can't remember her name, who is really involved with training this kind of stuff. So that's the background of what we're talking about today. Last time I talked about needs as a doorway to compassion. So that was like part one of this talk. And today will be more about feelings. Just briefly, if people haven't heard of it before, nonviolent communication in brief is these kind of four steps. And they are being able to state an observation clearly, separately from judgments and evaluations. That's the first step. That's starting somewhere where everybody can agree. The second step is feelings. And feelings is where we'll spend most of our time today, but we're talking really about emotions. And the trick here is not confusing our thoughts with emotions or calling thoughts emotions. The third step is needs. And needs, the key there is making sure that we've arrived at something that's universal. And it isn't a strategy. So the difference here, like a strategy is tied to a person, a place, or a thing, or a time. A need is something universal. So if you're trying to find or figure out, let's say if you're in a difficult conversation with somebody and you're trying to figure out what their need is, if you can't get behind what you think their need is, you haven't gotten to the need yet, because needs are universal. And then the fourth step is the request, being able to make a clear request that is not a demand and is specific and achievable. An interesting point he makes in here is that if you can do the first three without a request, it can actually come off the wrong way. Like if you really are able to open up clearly and share an observation, your feelings and your needs, but then not ask somebody something clearly based on those, then they can take it the wrong way. So it's kind of important to be able. And I've seen this happen too, where people kind of they're earnest in their sharing, but they don't have a thing to say, and it can, you know, I'm going to put people in a weird space. So we got a lot to cover today. So let's start by saying the prayer of refuge. We have it on paper here. I hope this translation is the same. It may not be. Yeah, so let's do, we'll say this once in Tibetan, once in English, once in Tibetan. And when you do the English, let's read from the screen, if possible, because that way if people see this later on video, they can follow. O Sangye Chidan Soki Chodnam La Janchu Pardu Dani Kyapsu Chi Daki Jin Soki Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penchir Sangye Drupasho. I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of accomplishing generosity and the other perfections, may I attain enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. O Sangye Chidang Soki Chodnam La Janchu Pardu Dagni Kyapsu Chi Daki jin so ki pe sunam ki drola penchir sangye drupa sho. Laden sawe lama rinpoche daki jiwa pete ten chula kadrin chepo gone je zunte usun tuki nga drup sa du so. Okay. So one thing I want to cover just really quick right at the top, I'm trying to make this a regular part of what I do at any point in time, is to just have everybody take a quick check-in with where you're at. And I mean, particularly here, I mean where you're at between like totally spaced out or like as agitated and with the most racing mind you can imagine. On that scale, like 1 to 10, just kind of check in and see where you're at on that scale. And the reason I say to do this is because we all have a window of tolerance where engaging in particularly Buddhist meditation, which oftentimes pushes our level of comfort a little bit, we need to be aware when it's like the right time to do it and when it's time to maybe do some self-care instead. I mean, I don't know if you've all noticed, but a lot about Buddhism is not about getting comfort, you know? Like, we're doing a lot of things to try to extend our comfort zone and grow a little bit. And there's sometimes where that isn't the safest thing to do. So it's a good idea to keep in mind your window of tolerance. And generally, you should be between about a 3 and an 8. And if you're outside of that window of tolerance, it's not the end of the world. It just means you probably need to do some kind of self-care, whatever you need to kind of get back into that window of tolerance. And what that might be is some sort of relaxational meditation, you know, which is something that I've talked about a bit before. I mean, I think there's a lot of what's happened to Buddhist meditation in the U.S. has been it's turned into meditations to calm you down quickly. And that's not exactly what the Buddha taught. But there is use for those types of practices. And that might be the use, you know, when you need to get back inside that window of tolerance. So keep that in mind. Because we are going to engage in a couple meditations today. There's actually 4 sections in this book, but he talks about 3 steps to successful communication. And they are lead with presence, come from curiosity and care, and focus on what matters. So I'm going to break the talk into those kind of 3 areas today. I forgot to mention this part. So this is an important one. And this one, like, I'm amazed, like, this isn't said enough in our area. I mean, not just here, but I mean any Western Buddhist center. If you feel like you're outside of your window of tolerance, feel free to move. I mean, that's kind of just the first step. Feel free to shift. If you're in a big room of people meditating and it's quiet, there may be a lot of pressure to, like, be frozen in place. But you can move, you know. You can stand up, you can shift, whatever you need to do. So just always keep that in mind. So we'll do a couple short meditations today. With the first one here, I want to talk a little bit about balance. When we talk about the middle way, the teaching of the Buddha as the middle way, there's always some kind of balance. And being able to correctly identify what things we're balancing is often really important. So in particular, in the basic practice of shamatha that we teach downstairs at 10 a.m., we're talking about a balance between mindfulness and awareness. That's what we're cultivating in shamatha meditation, calm abiding meditation. And that means mindfulness is remembering to place the attention, and awareness is noticing when the mind has wandered. And we're cultivating both of those. And the reason it's important to know that is because I think most of us as achievers get set on the mindfulness aspect. Like, I want to always keep my mind right there. That's what I'm doing. But we're actually cultivating awareness too. And that awareness is what notices when our mind wanders. So in those moments where we might be disappointed, like, oh, my mind's wandering, that's the awareness, and we want that, you know? So that's, it's important to make a good relationship with that awareness that notices when the mind is wandering, because that's one of the things we're cultivating. So, but we need to balance the two. We remember where we're placing our attention. We also notice when the mind has wandered. Another way to think about that is as anchor and atmosphere. So we have a place where we're anchoring our attention, and then we have a whole atmosphere around where we placed our attention. And those two things need to be balanced, and they're also kind of interdependent, you know? A point of mindfulness happens within an atmosphere of infinite points of mindfulness. And so one of the things we work with in our practice of meditation is picking one point of mindfulness and placing our mind there. But that doesn't mean if something happens in the atmosphere around it, noises, physical sensations, thoughts, like that any of those things are a problem. We can notice those. The problem is getting pulled away by them, getting hooked. Shenpa is the Tibetan word. It means like getting hooked. But just noticing other stuff in the environment is okay. That's totally part of what we're doing here. So you can also think that when we talk about like shenpa and getting hooked, if you think about this boundless field of all these potential objects of mindfulness, you know, in the physical realm and in our mind and all that stuff, what normally happens when we're not watching or paying attention is that we jump from point to point. You know, our attention's here, and then it goes over here, and then it goes over here, and over here. And if you imagine taking a pen and drawing each of those, that open atmosphere around your point of mindfulness is going to start looking pretty crowded and overwhelmed and cluttered, right? And so that's another way to think about what we're doing with meditation when we place the attention. You know, we're allowing that spaciousness to exist around it without just jumping to every potential point. We can notice them, but we just stay placed on what we've chosen as our anchor. And if the mind does wander, no big deal. We notice it, bring our attention back. But there's a balance there, the balance between the anchor and the atmosphere. So let's do a little short meditation. I think a good summary of posture is a straight back and open heart. So wherever you're sitting, straight back and open heart. And we'll start by placing your attention at the very top of your head. And then move your attention down to the soles of your feet. And then place your attention on the sense of gravity where your body touches the seat. And then you can place your attention on your breath. These have all been anchors inside the body, So let's move our attention to the very edge of the body, where what you consider to be your physical body meets the world around it. You might even briefly consider, what is solid here? Is it the space around me, or is it what I consider myself? Then let go of this internal reference point and open your awareness outward to include your environment. You can even look around if you like. And then bring your attention back to one of those anchors inside your body. Breath, the sense of gravity, top of your head. And then let go of that reference point and open your awareness again to include the whole room. Now see if you can find the balance between your internal reference point and the environment. Try to place your attention on the connection between your inner and your outer world. Thank you. So one thing I was thinking about, particularly related to that meditation, is we talk a lot about the three gates, body, speech, and mind. And those are related, if you're familiar with the Buddha bodies, Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Dharmakaya. If you're not familiar with those, not a big deal. But we have to think about the connection between our inner and our outer worlds and between body and mind. And in the middle there is speech, communication. That's what kind of bridges between inner and outer world. And Sofer in this book points out that we use the same physiological process to speak as we do to breathe and sustain our life energy. So it's not only like the same process that's keeping us alive, it's also what bridges our inner world and our outer world. And so it doesn't need to be, and it probably shouldn't be random when we do use our speech. So it's something we need to be thinking about. And we start that with presence. So leading with presence is this first point here. And being present means being real. Being present means not cultivating a certain state. It means being here with what's happening and where who we are and where we are at a certain point in time. He says, presence builds the groundwork for connection. And the more aware we are in any given moment, the more choice we actually have, the more freedom we actually have. So those anchors we did inside the body, those are things you can use in your practice, your formal practice. You can use them throughout as you move throughout your day. And in particular, he provided them as a thing to use while you're in dialogue. It'll be a little bit less of the attention placed on those when you're actually in a conversation, but the idea is it's a method to maintain some presence and to keep some balance between our internal and our external world. So I gave a couple options. you may have noticed one of them resonated with you more, you know? So that's something to kind of notice, you know, what anchor worked the best for you. And then see if you can apply that throughout your day. A couple other suggestions he had in terms of cultivating this presence is in the beginning of the day, connecting with whatever that anchor was that works for you. Taking a few breaths and simply connecting with that anchor. And setting an intention to return to that anchor throughout the day. And then visualizing situations in which you will practice placing your attention on that anchor. Whether it's on your commute or in a meeting or in a specific dialogue with somebody. Just creating the intention ahead of time that that's something you're going to do. At the end of the day, he says to reflect and think about if you remembered to return to your anchor. And if so, when? And what was the effect? He also says at the end of the day, when you do this, to come from curiosity and care, which is step two of this process that we're about to talk about. He said, be wary of any self-judgment and examine your day with warmth and inquisitiveness. So you can visualize how you want to improve the next day. What would you like to do differently? Do you have ideas to help you remember to lead with presence? Now let's do another short meditation. In this meditation, I'm going to stand in for someone with whom you might be communicating. So this is something you can practice in daily life and in dialogue. So we'll take that straight back, open heart posture. And go ahead and place your attention on an internal reference point. And then let go of that reference point. Instead, place your attention on my voice. Not just my voice, but also your sense of my presence. And then as I continue to speak, shift your attention back to your internal reference point for a bit. And then you can shift your attention back out to me once again. Try gradually shifting your attention from your internal reference point to your sense of my presence. Now, can you find a balance between placing your attention on your internal reference point and placing your attention on me? Can you place your attention on the connection between us? Not on you or me, but our sense of being here together. Okay, thank you. This is a hard one to remember. A lot of this stuff is hard to remember. I've been working kind of exclusively with this book for the last 3 months, 4 months, and I can tell you that some of these things I remember some of the time, but Dharma's like that, you know, like we gotta put a lot of effort in and do our practice and try to remember as much as possible and celebrate the little improvements along the way, you know? So if you feel like this is something that you start to practice and you only sometimes remember to do it, or you only remember little pieces of it, that's still forward motion. You know, that's still progress and it's still good. So keep that in mind. He also points out that true presence always entails a tremble of uncertainty. And that means that we're actually in touch with reality. So something to remember. Uncertainty is something we need to get used to and comfortable with. And one of the main ways that we distract ourselves, or one of the main reasons we distract ourselves, is because we feel some kind of uncertainty. So if we can just kind of get used to a little bit of uncertainty, that's a big step forward. He also quotes a Zen saying that not knowing is the most intimate. So now if we move on to coming from curiosity and care. So once we've been able to establish some presence, then we establish our intention. And the intention here is the intention of curiosity and care. And if we don't consciously set our intention, we will likely default to self-centeredness. That's kind of our sort of a gravitational pull that we've all been working with, is this kind of, we can remember briefly to think of others and do virtuous things, but there's this pull towards ourselves, you know? So we need to always be correcting. It's said that all dharma is remedial. You know, we're always trying to remedy. So our intention is curiosity and care. And as we discussed last time, there is a circle of production leading from our view to our intentions, to our experience, and back again to our view. We talked about this last time, so if you want to watch the first version of this talk on KTC's YouTube page, you can. But just in brief, our view shapes our intention creates our experience, and our experience solidifies our view. So when we have a view of things as win-lose or right or wrong, our intention becomes one of protecting and defending. And this intention of protecting and defending produces an experience of fear and anxiety, and anger and aggression. And that anger and fear reproduces a view of things as win-lose, right-wrong. But if we shift our view to win-win, our intention transforms to care and collaboration. And that creates the causes for an experience of intimacy and safety and belonging. So to say that one more way, when our view is that interpersonal conflict is dangerous and a problem means that something is wrong, then we will blame and judge others for expressing their needs. And this inevitably leads to experiences of disconnection and alienation. But when we can cultivate the view that we share universal needs to be happy, and that conflict can be a ground for learning, our bodhisattva intention, the intention to achieve awakening for the benefit of other beings, that intention to connect and to care will yield experiences of connection and understanding and creativity. And he even uses the word synergy, which I love, because that was one of the things Kempo Carter Rinpoche told me in retreat. I asked him if, sometimes somebody will say a word you haven't heard in a long time, and then like 3 hours later, someone else says that word, and you're like, what is going on here? You know, and then it's in a TV show. Like, I asked him, like, does that mean anything? And he said, that's actually can be a sign of progress in your practice, that your practice is going well. And it's something to contemplate, because, you know, if we have some hand in our experiences, right? Like, that's kind of one of the fundamental things in Buddhism, is that we, you know, our actions have results, you know? And so there is a little coming together of our external world and our internal world that can happen when our practice is on, you know? So coming from curiosity and care is making, it makes understanding and connection the most important thing. And genuine connection means presence. We might say in Vajrayana Buddhism that open awareness of our mandala and the other beings within it would be a kind of genuine connection. Curiosity keeps us engaged and open, while care, the wish to benefit others, infuses that openness with virtue, with true loving kindness and compassion. And as we learned last time, if we can't understand the other person, we have not yet heard or discovered their need, the universal need underlying whatever their strategies are. Because it's the strategies that in situations that we have a problem with. It wouldn't be the needs. So as we try to determine their needs, we should try to practice some reflection. And I mean, not just internally, but literally trying to reflect back what we think we've heard or what we think we've come to understand about someone. And we do this ideally in the form of a question. And this is a conscious way of discerning our own projections from what other people are trying to convey to us. We can ask, you know, are you trying to say that you feel this way because you need blank? As I said, it's a conscious way of discerning our projections from what the other person is trying to convey because, I think this is another important distinction to keep in mind, we make our appearances in our experience. The appearances, that is, mind creates that. But it's important to make a distinction that we don't create the apparent objects. And what I mean here is that if you think of like a form, Kenpo Carter Rinpoche taught this here maybe like 10 years ago, and he talked about how appearances are whether we think something is pleasing or not pleasing or neutral. But the actual appearance, like the apparent object, I should say, is an interdependent phenomena. So because of our common karma, we see similar apparent objects. But I might see an object that I think is pleasing, and you might think that same object is not pleasing. So appearances are our perceptions of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. But apparent objects arise interdependently from our karma. So it's important to make that distinction because it's not like we make the whole world with our mind. Like if you think that and act upon that, that's how you go down the path of nihilism. So that's an important thing to note. We aren't making all the apparent objects with our mind. You know, it's our interdependent karma. That's how they arise. It's the appearances that we make. Like it's purely from our side that things are pleasing or not pleasing or neutral. So in terms of reflections again, if we believe the other person is saying they have a need for more time alone, we might say back to this person, so if I understand you correctly, you are saying you'd like to have more time to yourself each day. So practicing reflecting the thoughts of others to enhance understanding in a safe environment for problem solving is a good practice. And we should apply this often and in low stakes situation. And what I mean by that is like, most of this we're going to have to practice in the low-stakes situations. I mean, what are the odds we're going to remember to do this in the midst of some heated conflict, right? Like, and that's why our meditation is so important. It seems like just this thing we got to get up and do for 5 minutes in the morning, but we're practicing with a low-stakes situation, so later on in the day when something intense happens, we've actually got some practice working with our attachment and with our mind. So all of these kinds of things, we may think, oh, I'm going to use this the next time there's an argument or whatever, but the time to use this would be in the most simple, mundane conversations you have all day long, you know? So this is the thing that you should try practicing, even just in everyday conversation. That's where you'll build the habit and the practice. And this is positive habituation. It's training our mind for curiosity and care and for connection and compassion. So we could say it's applied mindfulness infused with bodhicitta. So now we'll move on to focusing on what matters. So presence sets the stage, intention points us in the right direction, and focus is about where we place our attention. So you recall earlier we placed the attention at the top of the head, and we moved it to the feet, and we moved it to the breath. You can move it to your fingertips or your palms. In the book, he talks about a center line, you know, like in the middle of your torso, placing your attention on that. So we can place our attention in many places. So where do we place it in dialogue? And this is where the four components of nonviolent communication come in: observations, feelings, needs, and requests. And this will, again, book study. We'll go into great detail with all of this stuff. So I highly recommend it. So those four points of observations, feelings, needs, and requests show us where it matters to put our attention in conversation. And as I said, today we're talking about feelings or emotional agility. And so the balance here, the middle way here, kind of the first middle way we usually talk about, like in terms of the life of the Buddha, is between materialism and nihilism. So the Buddha lived a life of luxury in a castle as a prince. He had all the comforts in life, didn't actually end up leading to happiness. Then he renounced all that, became an ascetic practitioner, gave up everything, lived in the woods, eating a grain of rice a day. That also didn't lead to happiness. And then he realized there needed to be a middle way. So kind of the most traditional way to talk about the middle way is materialism and nihilism. Or to say that another way, everything matters and nothing matters. You know, somewhere in the middle. And we're in this constant process of adjusting, balancing it. I love this. I thought of this analogy recently that I love. Like, you know, when you used to like lean back in a chair on the back two legs, you know, and you kind of try to stay balanced. And you're never actually just there, right? Like you're always, you know, and that's the process of balance, you know, that we're always engaged in. So that could be also a balance, a middle way between mindfulness and awareness, like we talked about. We talk about compassion and emptiness when we get into Mahayana Buddhism. That's also called skillful means and wisdom, a middle way between skillful means and wisdom. Tantra, Vajrayana Buddhism, we're talking about vivid and insubstantial. Our experience of the world is vivid and rich with detail, but it's also insubstantial. It's impermanent, it's changing, it's interdependent. So in communication, and in particular in emotions, we're talking about a middle way between acting out and suppressing. And if you're looking for another, I was going to say more Buddhist, but it's not particularly Buddhist, but Pema Chodron's book, How to Meditate, there's a whole chapter called about emotions and using the emotions as the support for meditation. And this is kind of exactly the same thing, but presented a little bit differently. So if you're looking for another place to get this kind of information, I would recommend that book. So, so the practice is being able to distinguish the felt sensation of our emotions from our thoughts and stories. And that's key to skillfully handling and expressing emotions, being able to distinguish just the tone of the emotion, just the energy. And this is important because we know the cost of reactively expressing our emotions can be excruciatingly high. Sometimes it takes months or years to repair those kind of things. A moment, you know, of acting out on an emotion. And sometimes they're not repairable. So we know it's important to find a balance, you know, where acting out isn't just something we do. We also need to be aware of the damage that suppressing emotions can do. I mean, it doesn't really work. And our unacknowledged emotions can wreak havoc on our communication, causing us to construct entire narratives of negative assumptions about other people. And it's all to try to make sense of our own unrecognized feelings. So we have to find the middle way between reactive expression and habitual suppression of our emotions. And we can do this with curiosity and care. He says in particular, we have to develop for emotional agility, we have to develop the abilities to identify emotions, to find a balance in our internal experience of them, and to be able to express them openly and skillfully without blame or judgment. And that without blame or judgment, expression of them is what we're talking about with observations and requests. So we're not really gonna go into that today, but we're gonna talk about identifying emotions and finding balance. So first exercise that you can try he calls seeking myths. And the idea here is that we are habituated by our environment to think there are certain emotions we're allowed to feel and express depending on certain factors like our gender or our age or culture. And this can lead to a lot of anxiety and shame and depression. So a contemplation you could do is, what messages did you receive from your family, culture, religion, or society about emotions? So part of what we're doing here is just waking up, to use the word of the building, you know, Buddha. Bud means to wake up, to be awake, you know. So we're waking up to what's going on here, you know. So what messages did you receive from your family, culture, religion, or society? He also says, which are explicit, like don't cry, and which are implicit, like through example or behavior. Are there certain emotions that feel more acceptable than others? And then as you move through your day, notice any fear of feeling your emotions or of others expressing their emotions. And I think in particular, in a Dharma community, it's important to think about some potentially wrong ideas we may have developed about what we should and shouldn't feel as Buddhists or as Buddhist practitioners. And it's important to recognize that according to the Vajrayana, there is nothing to be discarded. In fact, the five main negative emotions we talk about, ignorance, desire, pride, jealousy, and anger, are the five wisdoms. Those are the five aspects of enlightened wisdom, but in our confusion, we experience them as negative emotions. But we can't throw those away. We need to clear away the confusion so that we can see what's actually going on. You know, so it's really important, I think, especially for us, because we come in here, we care for each other, we chant stuff, we meditate, but nobody in here is perfect, you know? And we're all working with these negative emotions. So it's really important not to, I think it's possibly more likely in a community like this to suppress, you know, at least when we're together, you know. But keep in mind, like, there is a middle way, you know, between acting out and suppressing. So knowing that those five negative emotions actually are the wisdoms, the only path out is through, you know. So don't throw those out or hide them. So we feel emotions for a reason. And he talks about this as reclaiming our right to feel, that our emotions are a sign that something matters. And in particular, we feel good when our needs are met, and we feel not good when our needs are not met. So we need to see emotions as information. He says, think of them like a smoke detector. Sorry for the analogy here, for people who've been around for a while, but you know, when a smoke detector goes off, you know something's happening. You don't go throw away the smoke detector, you know. You try to figure out why it's going off. And that's the idea. When an alarm sounds, we need to seek out the source and not just destroy the smoke detector. So we can begin to see our emotions as information rather than like a call to act out or suppress. Emotions are okay to feel. It's how we respond that matters. So there are two parts here we're going to talk about, emotional recognition and emotional regulation. That's identifying emotions and finding balance. So Oren Sofer says, mindfulness is the primary tool to develop our capacity to identify emotions, emotional recognition, and to feel them with balance, emotional regulation. So for most of us, our vocabulary of emotions is pretty limited. We have maybe just a few words, angry, happy, sad, confused. In Buddhism, there's this basic five negative emotions, ignorance, anger, pride, desire, and jealousy. But there's actually a rich palette of emotions that we could familiarize ourselves with. So we have these five. We could maybe break that down to needs met, needs unmet. Expand that out a little bit to, like, if your needs are met, you may feel peaceful or loving or glad or playful or interested. Needs unmet, mad, sad, scared, tired, confused. But it spins out even more. So this is maybe a little overwhelming, but I wanted to show you some of the examples. This isn't even all of the examples he has in the list in the book of all the emotions that we potentially have, you know. So there's lots of nuance to this energy that we call emotion. You know, there's a lot of nuance here that we may not be noticing or discerning. So one of the first steps in being able to identify emotions, aside from just placing the attention, is starting to learn what some of them are. And you can find, by the way, this list and other lists on, they're in this book. There's also, like, Nonviolent Communication has lists of this on their websites. So I would just suggest, you know, try to learn some emotions. And, you know, I mean, I was really surprised. Like, I feel most of these. You know, I just hadn't ever really thought or looked closely enough to say it. So naming emotions is a first step to mindful communication and emotional recognition. And we can refine this ability. One way is by feeling emotions in our body. So for instance, if you're feeling a wave of emotion coming on, you can place your attention on the surge of energy that we call that emotion. And notice in your body, how does it feel? So you may think right now, like, what does joy feel like? What does it feel like when you have great joy, like, physically? Or what does sadness feel like? What things happen in your body? Because there's an interdependence of emotion in our bodily affects. Sadness may make us slouch our shoulders or lower our head, whereas confidence straightens us up. And the reverse is true, too. You know, if we force a smile, we can actually begin to feel a little happier, you know. So through connecting with the physical expression of our emotions, we become better at identifying what we're feeling. And gradually, our emotional palette will expand. And I was thinking, this is like being a sommelier of emotion, you know. You might, like, nose is a pungent insecurity, hints of startled and confused, you know, and then palate is hurt and animosity, with a long, toasty resentment for a finish, you know. So this is a real practice, you know, like, this is something we can and should do. And this is a great way to work with these waves of emotion, because what do we usually do when those waves roll in? We jump into blame, and we jump into win and lose. So here's a great thing we can do otherwise that's going to help us communicate better and also prevent us from going into these negative self-cherishing habits. So that's an emotional recognition step, but then we have to think about emotional regulation. So remember, emotions have, like, a general tone to them, and we describe that tone as pleasant or unpleasant, or neutral. I've shown that here as the waves, because it's usually the space between the waves that we just think of as neutral. When those big surges of energy come through, then we're going to label that as either pleasant or unpleasant. And that's what we call the three objects in the Lojong teachings of Mahayana Buddhism. And whatever we meet, we'll have one of these three general tones. But then we react to those tones with either attachment, aversion, or ignorance. And we refer to these as the three poisons. So it's our inability to tolerate the intensity of emotions that sparks our reactivity. So when we encounter something unpleasant, we don't like that, we generate aversion. If we encounter something pleasant, we want to grab that, not let it go, you know? And if it's neutral, we just are generally not awake, you know? We just stay ignorant. So that's, the three poisons happen in reaction to the three objects, but they don't have to. And just quickly, if you know this picture, the Wheel of Life, complicated, really fascinating iconography of like how our cycle of suffering arises. And there's a lot going on in here. But suffice to say, the middle, the very center of all of this is the three poisons. So everything else, that whole cycle of suffering arises because of attachment, aversion, and ignorance. So we're talking about important stuff here, you know. So here's just an example of like what our experience might be like waves of reactive experience. One wave comes along, it's pleasant, we generate attachment. Nothing happens for a little while, we decide not to stay awake, we become ignorant, you know. Then something comes along, it's unpleasant, we generate aversion. And so we're constantly getting battered around by these waves of experience and energy. But we can utilize mindfulness to place our attention on the tone of the emotion, rather than launching into a story or a rumination or any other kind of reactivity. The tone or the energy of an emotion can be an object of meditation. Just like your breath, or a sense of gravity, or a Buddha image. And like with mindfulness and physical pain, placing the attention on the emotion counterintuitively can lessen our suffering. So there's been research that like placing your attention on pain, like if you have chronic pain, it actually reduces suffering because you're not going off into the story. You know, and so it's the same thing with emotion. It prevents us from going into the extremes of reactivity or suppression. So our developing our ability to place our attention on the tone and energy of emotions makes it so we can stand stably amidst these waves of emotion without getting tossed about. And this is why establishing a foundation of shamatha practice is essential groundwork for any compassion meditation and should always precede compassion meditation. We have to hone our awareness of our habit to leap into the stories and rumination, our habit to leap into the poisons. We have to hone our ability to notice that process happening, and that's why shamatha meditation is foundational. That's the first thing we do and we try to improve with, because it highlights our tendency to react to the three objects with the three poisons. So instead, by placing our attention on the tone of an emotion without leaping into reactivity or suppression, we naturally cultivate a simple, direct experience of the tone of our emotions. We place our attention on the energy underlying our manufactured stories. Then, once we've connected with that tone, then the last step is to connect to the stories and the meanings associated with those emotions that we've accurately identified. And we have to do this last because of the cycle of feeding between emotions and stories. Emotions tend to feed stories, which can feed more emotion, which feeds more stories. This is like I mentioned before, that 90-second thing. They found that like when you have strong emotions, the physiological reaction lasts 90 seconds. That's it. But when we have a bad day and something bad happens, like we can feel bad all day long, right? It's a lot more than 90 seconds. But I think the key is looking at what we were doing 90 seconds after it happened, you know? Probably some kind of story. And that keeps things spinning. So we have this cycle of feeding between stories and emotions. So the first thing to do is just place the attention on the tone. then we can start to try to connect with our needs. And so when we connect with the story, it has to be with clarity about what we're feeling and with the recognition that all the swirling energy and thought is indicating our own need, our own deep needs, and our current perception of it being met or unmet. And it's that deep need that we're looking for. So let's talk about blame. So the biggest myth about our emotions is that they're somebody else's fault. And he calls this hacking the blame game in the book. So we perpetuate this myth that emotions are someone else's fault every time we say things like, I'm angry because you. So the reason, what I'm trying to say here is the reason is we have this A to B relationship where we think that there's events, and then because of the event, there's an emotion. So an example could be like if someone's late and you're mad that they're late, you know. But like what if you were busy all day, and maybe you're like me, you're a little bit of an introvert, you've been talking to people all day long, and then you get 20 minutes to just sit at the restaurant, and they show up late. You're like, wow, thanks, I really appreciated that little break, you know? So clearly it wasn't just the event that equaled the emotion. There was something in the middle there. And so our feelings never directly caused by other people or other events. They may be the stimulus, but the direct cause of our emotions is how we relate to the event. So what it actually is an event, our needs, and then our emotion. It's an ABC kind of situation. I'm going to read two powerful paragraphs from this book. We are each responsible for our actions and our reactions. Remember that our feelings are a function of our needs. To take responsibility for my reactions means training my mind to trace emotions back to the needs from which they arise. Every time my attention goes outward to blame someone, I can pause and investigate. Is this person solely responsible for my reaction? What meaning am I making out of this event? What do I need? How is the broader context of my life or my social location structuring my experience? When we step out of the blame game and take radical responsibility for our feelings, we carve the channels of our own freedom. If you are the cause of my emotions, you have power, and I remain helpless. When we understand feelings as a function of needs rather than the direct result of another's actions, we reclaim our autonomy and agency. This is how humans facing brutal treatment, torture, and other horrors can feel compassion instead of hatred towards their oppressors. Our emotional life becomes an extension of our own values and a barometer for our needs rather than a liability or a weakness we need to protect. So I'm noticing we have come up at the end of the hour. Just quickly, I want to cover a couple other ways of spotting this. So for instance, when we say, I feel blank because you, that's an A to B kind of thing happening. A better construction would be, I feel blank because I need, want, or value blank. Or, this is actually a good place to stop. These techniques of nonviolent communication and all of this stuff, I think most of us probably are thinking this in terms of what I can do and when I speak and will I remember to do this. But maybe the most useful thing about all this for me has been trying to understand other people better through this. So for instance, if somebody says to me, I'm mad because you blank, I might ask, are you saying you feel angry because you need such and such? And I may not even say that out loud. I may just in my mind try to think, okay, they need this thing. I understand them needing this, so I understand why they're feeling that way. So another way to say this in general is you can translate other people, what other people are saying to you with these techniques in a way that's really beneficial for you and for them. I mean, it can really transform the whole way we experience dialogue, conversation. So I think I should leave some time for questions. I will say that because I want to respect everybody's time, we don't have long, but if you need to go, that's okay. But I also want to make some time if people have questions.
Lama Adam.
You're welcome.
I enjoyed that talk.
Thank you.
You know, one of the, so much of that was, got right through and I connected with, it occurred to me that the, one of the three reactions is more mysterious to me.
Yeah.
And that's the neutrality and the ignorance one, right?
Yes.
Like reacting with attraction or aversion, get that, right? And it's kind of active. Whereas, neutrality and the relationship of that to a choice to be ignorant is sort of a harder thing to, I think it's harder to catch myself on it, honestly. So I just wondered if you might comment about that.
Yeah, you're onto something for real there. Yeah, that's big. I mean, and so we talk about Buddha means awake. The opposite of that is like ignorance, you know, and like Chuck said, like there is an element of volition in ignorance. Like we're actually, at some level, electing to ignore, you know. And that was, when I learned that, it was long after I'd been in Buddhism. So like one teacher said that to us while I was in retreat, and that blew my mind. Like I hadn't thought about the fact that like ignorance actually means that we're actually doing something actively. And so, ignorance is what we talk about as the root of all this stuff. So we can talk about the three poisons on a second level, you know, ignorance and attachment and aversion, but the cause of all of it is the ignorance. So it's really the most pernicious part is the ignorance and the neutrality. And I think what's cool is like you expressed curiosity about it. That's the opposite of ignorance, you know? So that's great. I mean, I think we all should be looking in to that neutrality aspect, you know? The idea isn't like you have to look at everything in the whole world all the time. It's just constantly be awake. Like we should always be awake and engaged, even if something's neutral. There's remedial value in that. So it's interesting. I mean, that's really kind of exactly what we mean by presence, you know, and even cultivating presence that's steady and clear counteracts ignorance, you know, because at least you're not checking out, you know. So, yeah. Thank you. Any other questions?
I didn't quite understand what you just responded to Chuck. I used to think ignorance was like the absence of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Absence of curiosity.
Yeah.
Is that?
I'll try to come at it from another angle. So, first of all, just if you think about the word, like that, I was with you until someone pointed this out to me. Like the root of that's ignore. Like, and it just never occurred to me. Like, oh, huh? Because I always just thought it was the absence of knowledge too. But that we might call something different. But ignorance. Ignore is the root of that, so it's built in. But what Thukpa Dampche Rinpoche said when he taught us about this, he said that he used the analogy of that we often refer to when we talk about like where did all this confusion start, and what's usually said is at some point we became overwhelmed by our nature, like we became overwhelmed by this limitless and clear nature, and in that like instant of becoming overwhelmed, we started to cling. Like we would if we got scared, you might grab something, you know, like and what we grabbed was self, you know, because we wanted to protect self from other. And then all this big mistake kind of occurred. So in that initial moment, we got overwhelmed and we no longer wanted to look at things as they were. Like we no longer wanted to see things as they actually are. And we instead went to this habitual clinging to a self, which leads to a sense of other. And from that sense of duality comes negative emotions, friction, and because of that we act, and that creates karma, and that creates all of this. So there is an active moment. I mean, it is such a subtle volition in there, but it's a hopeful volition Because if what Tukul-Dampchen Rinpoche was telling me, and I'm what I'm doing my best to understand and explain now, is that if there is a volitional element in our ignorance, then we can stop doing that. You know?
That's all a big answer.
So I want to finish with 2 points, because these were his 2 principles. He said, the more we take responsibility for our feelings, connecting them with our needs rather than others' actions, the easier it is for others to hear us. Similarly, the more we hear others' feelings as a reflection of their needs, the easier it is to understand them without hearing blame, needing to agree, or feeling responsible for their emotions. Doesn't this seem like a great thing to work on as a community? You know? So let's say the prayer of dedication. I put it on the screen. I'm not sure if this is the same one you have there, but we'll just do this one. By this merit, may I and all beings obtain the omniscience of Buddhahood and defeat our common enemy, wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may we free all beings. And until then, surf's up. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.